Welcome to Facts Roundtable, a podcast dedicated to navigating life with food allergies across the lifespan, presented in a welcoming format with interviews and open discussions. Each episode will explore a specific topic, leaving you with the facts to know or use. Information presented via this podcast is educational and not intended to provide individual medical advice. Please consult with your personal board-certified allergist or healthcare providers for advice specific to your situation. Hi, everyone. I'm Caroline Mwasisi, and I am your host for the Fact Roundtable podcast. I am a food allergy parent, advocate, and the founder of the Grateful Foodie blog, and I am Fact's Vice President of Community Relations. Before we start today's very interesting conversation, I just want to pause for just a moment to say thank you to DBV Technologies for being a very kind sponsor of Facts Roundtable podcast. Please note that today's guest was not sponsored by DBV or compensated in any way by the sponsor to participate in this specific podcast. Gut diversity has been a hot topic, and what does this mean to people with food allergies, and how can we address our gut microbiome? We're exploring what gut diversity means to people with food allergies. We'll also discuss how to prevent food allergies and the role of food in this protocol with Karina Venter, a professor and registered dietitian who works with the food allergy community as an allergy specialist dietitian. Welcome, Karina, to Facts Roundtable Podcast. I am absolutely delighted and thrilled to have you on the podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me, Caroline.
This is such an exciting topic because this is actually the first time that we've even discussed gut diversity on Facts Roundtable Podcast. But before we start our conversation, you have a very interesting background. So can you explain to our listeners your background, not only as an allergy specialist dietitian, but then your role at Children's Hospital Colorado?
Good. So yes, I'm a dietitian by background. I studied in South Africa, and my little claim to fame is I studied at the same dietetic department as May Musk, Elon Musk's mom. After that, I went to England where I did my master's and my PhD then in allergy and immunology. From there, I moved to Cincinnati Children's Hospital where I did 2.5 years working mainly in eosinophilic esophagitis. But I was then recruited to Children's Hospital Colorado where I'm now working again more research related on prevalence of allergic diseases and really the prevention of allergic diseases through nutritional strategies. Maternal diet in pregnancy is something I've been studied for 20 years. It's really one of the things I'm extremely interested about. I'm also now doing some research on the maternal diet during breastfeeding and how that may affect breastfeeding composition. And then the infant diet, early introduction of allergen, and then the overall diet diversity and how that relates to allergy outcomes. So my research is about 70% of my time. And then I spend about 20 to 30% of my time in clinic where I just love being a dietitian. And so I give advice on milk avoidance, improving diversity of the diet, also am involved in oral immunotherapy. And I give a lot of prevention advice in terms of early introduction of allergens. So I think that sort of like summarizes it.
Well, that's a very deep and exciting career. And listeners, before we came live, I was talking to Karina about how I wish I had known her years ago when I was trying to sort out my son's allergies and understanding nutrition, you know, especially when our kids are allergic to so many proteins. So I am so happy now to see so many dietitians like you focusing on this. And then especially you go a step farther and you're doing all this amazing research.
Well, thank you. I think, you know, for me, the biggest change I've seen, you know, in the food allergy world over the last 20 years is the fact that we used to believe that allergens are just really bad. You know, if you're allergic, you have to completely avoid the food under all circumstances. And we never should feed babies food allergens. And we pregnant and breastfeeding women should never eat allergens. Of course, you know, we've now made a big U-turn where we say avoidance is not necessary unless you are allergic to the food. But even then, We're learning every single day about individual thresholds and also cofactors that may affect those individual thresholds, so that some people can perhaps get away with 300 milligram of peanut protein. But like you just said, other than just saying eat a little bit of that, we're now in a position where we can quantify what that little bit means, because a little bit more than a little bit may be fatal, but the little bit may actually help with tolerance induction. So I spend a lot of my time educating families about safe levels of consumption of individual allergens, of course, always under the guidance of the allergist that I work with, but definitely very exciting field where we can now actually quantify what a little bit means and when that little bit is safe and when that little bit is most definitely not safe.
This is exciting, and you explained it so beautifully too. Thank you. So now let's just jump into today's topic, which is gut diversity. So let's just start off from the basics. What is gut diversity? You know, we see it in the news, we see it in the headlines, we hear about the microbiome, but can you just give us the basics?
Yeah, so I have this wonderful friend and colleague, Professor Liam O'Mahony from University College Cork in Ireland, and I do all my microbiome research in collaboration with Liam, and he explains gut diversity so well. He says it's when you look at a playground at a school, and if there's only two kids, they may argue. If there's only three kids, they may still argue. But if you all of a sudden have a playground full of children, different sizes, different shapes, different genders, different cultural backgrounds, he said then all of a sudden there's peace on the playground, because there's now many kids with many different interests and backgrounds, and everybody plays nicely together. And that really is what gut diversity relates to, is the more of healthy gut bacteria we have, the more we have like equilibrium or peace in the gut to make all the chemicals that we need in the gut. One of the chemicals that the gut produces is called butyrate. It's a short chain fatty acid, if you're interested in that. And butyrate then directly talks to the immune cells to help us to develop tolerance. So there's a good reason why we want to have a diverse gut microbiome, because that way we make the chemicals we need that's going to tell the immune cells that it's acceptable to be tolerant to this peanut protein or this egg protein. So we definitely want peace on the playground and peace in the gut.
So in finding like that peace, is it done through food, or is it done through supplements? Is it done through talking to a dietitian, and all of the above?
Yeah, probably a little bit of all of the above. Now, I wish that I could say to you that once you have a very unhealthy, or what we call dysbiotic gut, that just eating a healthy diet can correct it. And perhaps just eating a healthy diet in some people may help to correct it. But we also have data where we show that once the gut microbiome is that dysbiotic or unbalanced, you can put as many healthy foods in the gut, it will come out almost all undigested, because you just don't have the right bacteria to break those foods down. So in some people, we will need a good probiotic. And I'm sorry that I can't define a good probiotic for you, and I can't give you a brand name. We're trying to learn about that all the time. But if you just want sort of like my elevator pitch on what a good probiotic is, you need at least 9 billion bacteria. And the more probiotics that's in the supplement, probably the better. You don't just want to take just one strain or one type of bacteria. So you need enough. You need the 9 billion. I think I said million. It's 9 billion. You also need to have a variety. And it is definitely worth contacting the company to find out if they've done any studies to make sure that these bacteria will reach your gut alive. Because it's probably also pointless to take probiotics that's already killed, although some people say they may still have a small role to play, but you really want live bacteria to get in your gut. So that's sort of like the probiotic side. Now, once you're taking a probiotic, how long do you have to take it for? We don't know. We know we can change the gut bacteria within 3 days, but it can turn back into an unhealthy gut a bacteria within 3 days again. So we normally say about 2 to 4 weeks on a probiotic, and then making sure that we get a healthy, diverse diet eaten by the child or the adult alongside the probiotic to really support the growth of the probiotics. And then perhaps after 2 to 4 weeks, you can stop. Some people may suggest that you continue for much longer, but I would say less than 2 to 4 weeks is probably not going to be sufficient to really get the good bacteria colonized or growing into the gut.
Wow, you have totally lifted the veil on this. That was a burning question I've had for years. Thank you. I'm sure listeners are appreciating that as well. So now how does then the gut microbiome impact people with food allergies? So how is our community a little different, and what should we be thinking about?
So I will get back to the gut bacteria again, but I do want to talk about the diet first. We know, or we think at least we know, that a more diverse or varied diet helps to nurture a diverse and healthy gut microbiome. But what do we do in food allergy? We tell people to take foods out of their diet. So we're actually reducing their diet diversity for their safety and because we don't want to have any reactions. If we're not seeing a dietitian alongside that advice to just take things out of the diet, the children or the adults will end up with a less diverse diet. And I've actually published that data to show that children avoiding cow's milk have a less diverse diet than children who can eat cow's milk. And you know, the more food you take out of the diet, so the more complex the food allergies are, the less diverse the diet gets. And you know, we always talk about nut allergies and the importance of the nut proteins, but nuts are an extremely good source of fiber that's helping to get the gut microbiome to grow. So even if you say, but I'm just a nut allergic, it doesn't affect my diet, it's probably not true. And we need to think about other ways to get fiber in your diet. Perhaps rather than eating white rice, we can have brown rice, or we can have quinoa, or perhaps rather than having cornflakes every morning. And I know that every person with food allergies travel with a little bit of rice checks, because we know it's safe. But perhaps then when you're home, we can have more oatmeal and we can have a bit more grits and another suitable type of high fiber cereal. To say what's special about people with food allergies is the fact that we're advising them to take food out of their diet. And therefore, we need to make sure that we advise them appropriately how to replace these foods to have a diverse diet. The other thing about people with food allergies is, you know, for very good reasons, they probably distrust food a little bit. And so we do see a lot of people call it picky eating. In England, they call it fatty eating. Some people may say that the correct term really is selective eating behavior, but they're always going to be restricted, or many people with food allergies, in terms of the foods that they're willing to eat, just because they've eaten so many things that made them feel unwell in the past. So we also have to, on a second level, have to then give them advice on working within their texture preferences and taste preferences to make sure we get the diet as diverse as possible. And that really, we've now shown that if you have a diverse diet, that the more diverse your diet in terms of just foods or in terms of the more food allergens you eat, the more diverse the gut microbiome is. And the reason we want a more diverse gut microbiome is, as I've previously referred to, that really induce production of all these chemicals in the gut that's going to help the immune cells to become tolerant or develop tolerance. Now, after everything I've just said, you know, I am also a hardcore scientist. Nobody has ever done the study to show that children with a more diverse diet, if they have a food allergy, develop tolerance to allergens by 2 years instead of 4 years, or 4 years instead of 10 years. So that really straight line still needs to be drawn. But from the observational evidence we have, it would make sense to say it's probably more beneficial to try and get a diverse diet, as diverse as possible, so that we can get as a diverse gut microbiome as possible with all the important bacteria that we need in the gut to help with tolerance induction. And I wonder, I know I've given you a long answer, but there's a level to this as well. I know that mothers with children with picky eating behavior can get very stressed when they see me in clinic and they say, oh, we looked you up on the internet. You're all about diet diversity and gut microbiome diversity. And my child's actually only eating two foods or three foods. And you're going to be very unhappy with us. And so my answer is always, every additional food counts. My data on prevention from the Isle of Wight showed that with every additional food a child eats in the first year of life, we can bring the risk of developing food allergy down by about 11%. And I think to some extent, this may be true for children with already developed food allergies. Every additional food counts. And so I say to the mom, we're on two foods today, or the dad, whichever parent's coming to see me. Let's try and have three by next week. And perhaps by the end of the month, we can have four foods. And perhaps 6 months from now, who knows, we may be on 10 foods. We're not expecting today that you'll be leaving this office with this child eating 200 foods. And every food counts. So don't be stressed about it. We work with the child. We work with the child's preferences. We're not force feeding anybody. You know, I want families to relax about this whole issue of diversity and make the best they can. You know, some children may eat five fruits and no vegetables. That's five fiber-containing foods, you know. We'll work on the vegetables as time goes by, but let's focus on the good things we already have in the diet.
Well, and I think sometimes too, when you're dealing with your child and a health condition, you know, you become a little myopic and you're just very, very focused and you don't think of other foods that might be safe and might be okay. So I think it is really helpful to work with someone who, like you said, is saying, okay, we've got five fruits, let's focus on these and we're going to eventually move out and here's some new ones that I'm sure people haven't even thought about. I mean, I do the same thing in the grocery store, right? I'll write my list out. Then I get to the grocery store, I'm like, oh, look, there's bok choy. Well, I could pick that up. And we just don't think that way.
It is, you know, and sometimes even if we don't increase the number of foods, but we can increase the textures. Like, for example, you know, a child who will eat apples, you can make applesauce. You can make apple lollies. You can cut the apple and bake it in the oven to have like apple crisps. You can grate the apple so you have a different texture than just biting into an apple. So that may be things that dietitians spend a lot of time discussing with families as well, which I honestly do not think allergists have time to do. So that is why you really need to ask to speak to an allergy dietitian, you know, or just oatmeal. You know, some children may not like oatmeal. It's a strange texture for many people, but let's make some granola bars. And all of a sudden, you may have a child who absolutely loves oat, and it's fantastic fiber to have in the diet. So these are the kind of things to think about. But I think my main message really is don't be too hard on yourself. We do what we can do. We do the best we can do.
That is a wonderful message to share with our listeners. So now let's turn our focus over to food allergy prevention and the role of the gut, and then how food is actually used in that food allergy prevention, which is so funny because it almost sounds like an oxymoron, right? You're using food to prevent food allergy. So you don't mind going into that for us.
So my research have shown that, you know, the more diverse diet babies have in the first year of life, so you just count every single food they eat, apple, tomato, you know, potato, meat, beef, lamb, chicken, and the more different foods they eat, the less likely they are to have food allergies. And I think there was a big lesson for us to learn because, like I said previously, we used to be so scared. But in our foods and feeding babies, and we wanted to delay introduction of food. But then on top of the layer of saying that the more diverse or the more varied their diet is, we also found that the more allergens they eat. So with every additional food allergen the babies ate in the first year of life, their risk of developing food allergies came down by about 33%, which is huge if you think about previously where we just said avoid the allergens until they 3 and 5. And now we're seeing that the more allergens we get in, the better. Now, this is observational data, and so nobody has ever done what we call a randomized controlled trial to show it works. But the beauty is the data that I'm quoting was data when I worked in the United Kingdom. This has been shown in 5 centers in Europe. We now have publications coming out of Asia, both Korea and China showing the exact same thing. And we now have data in the maternal diet showing that the more varied mom's diet, the less likely the child is to have food allergies. This is data here from America. And then we've just published our paper from a cohort in Sweden. So I think all in all, we get this very consistent message that if we relax about food restrictions and we eat what we like, as often as we like, as varied as we can, it reduces risk of food allergy. Does that mean that children with food allergies, mothers did not have a diverse diet? It's not as simple as that. It's like a linear graph. The more diverse, the less likely, but there's no cutoff to say you haven't eaten enough diversity. And the same with your child. If your child has got allergies, it doesn't necessarily mean they didn't have a diverse diet as infants. Again, that's also a linear graph with no particular cutoff point. But interestingly, you know, to say that it just reemphasized the whole fact that we can use food to prevent food allergy. The more we eat and the more diverse, the better.
Well, thank you for explaining that. So for someone listening who wants to look at the, you know, prevention, early prevention, and how to create more gut diversity, what do you suggest they do? Should they look for a registered dietitian? Are there websites that list, you know, medically vetted dietitians? What should they do?
Yes, I wish we had a list of dietitians that I could refer them to. They could reach out to FACT, you know, because there's some dietitians involved with FACT, but the dietitians involved in FACT are all part of the International Network of Diet and Nutrition in Allergy, in short, in DANA. So they can reach out to us. We can get dietitians. Something I have to explain to families, because many people reach out to me and then I can't help them. We are very limited with our licenses in the United States. If I'm licensed in Colorado, where actually we don't have a license, I can't see anybody in New York because I don't have a New York license. I can't help somebody in Chicago because I don't have a Chicago license. And so this is why we really need to find dietitians local to the state. So there's ways, I would say, through patient organizations that you can get hold of names. But, you know, diet diversity, the reason I like that is it's not a complex science. It's as simple as, let's buy bananas today, apples tomorrow, mango the day after. We've also published some data looking at, you know, socioeconomic factors in terms of diet diversity. It doesn't have to be star fruit and cantaloupe. You know, it can be peaches in peach season, and it can be, you know, 3 different colors tomatoes if that's on special, or it can be, like you already referred to, spinach and bok choy when the bok choy is, you know, on a special offer. It doesn't really have to be a very extensive, very expensive fruit and vegetables. Look what's locally available, look what's on offer. But I think as moms, because we were taught that foods are bad for allergy prevention and foods, if you eat foods, that causes allergy, I think many of us stuck to banana for 5 days, and then we had apple for 5 days, and then we might have given oranges for 5 days. But now we know every meal can have a different fruit and a different vegetable and a different grain. And so that's what I would say to moms, is just really go into the supermarket and look at as many different things you can buy, you know, rather than having, you know, chicken every night, have some chicken and some fish and some pork or beef, whatever your preference may be. I think it's very easy to get stuck in eating just certain foods, but we really need to just open up our own food repertoire, and that would just lead to our children having so much more varied diet. You don't need to see a dietitian for that.
very sage and wonderful advice, especially for our pocketbooks. And I think, again, sometimes when something is so new to us, it feels like this big mountain, but you just brought that down to a nice little molehill that, you know, we can deal with.
Yeah. And, you know, I have families where the children, when they come and see me, they just love this whole diversity thing and having a look in the supermarket. And they actually, they sent me emails, you know, a week later, because I always say 30 different plant-based foods are the best diversity we can have for a good diverse gut microbiome. That's data from the American Gut Study. And so they actually then write down every kind of fruit, vegetable, and grain they're eating. And then they see who can get to the 30 different ones, you know, first in the household. So I often get things like, does the parsley count? You know, you really need to have about an ounce of something for it to count. So a little bit of parsley is not really going to count for diversity. But the children love it because that's something, control that they can take over their diets. And they can pick whatever they like. Just perhaps something else I can say to moms is, if you don't even want to think about diversity, just let the kids loose when you go shopping.
That's fun. What a great idea. Well, before we wrap up today, is there anything else that you would like listeners to hear from you?
I think, you know, I've done a study in the United Kingdom to ask what parents would like from a nutrition consultation. And the interesting thing was, nobody really said label reading, you know, which is what they often get when they get to see allergy dietitians. And that, of course, is a part of our role. But it was really that emotional support and reassurance that you're doing the right thing and you're doing your best. And I would say, if there's families out there that's really struggling with new diagnosis or even pre-existing diagnosis, do ask to see a dietitian. Marian Groach and I recently wrote a paper to talk about, you know, all the different life stages. So if I see a baby in clinic, you know, I'm going to talk about introduction of solid foods. I'm not going to talk about drinking when you're 21 and which alcohol are suitable. And I'm not going to talk about sleepovers when you're 15 and going on school trips when you're 12. So as you're going through all these different life stages, your child may have had a diagnosis for 12 years by the time they're 12, or for 21 years by the time they get their first job. These are all new struggles to you, and these are all new reasons why you need to see a dietitian. And also nutritional needs change over the life course. So what was suitable in terms of calcium and iron intake for an infant may not be suitable for a teenage girl. So don't try and do this by yourself. If you're really struggling, get a referral, and dietitians are there to help you through every single stage of your child's life course.
Well, thank you. That was great information. This entire podcast was just a wealth of much needed information. So I really appreciate your time. I know you were so busy, but thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I look forward to when we have you again on the Facts Roundtable podcast.
Thank you.
Once again, I would like to say thank you to DBV Technologies for being a very kind and generous sponsor of Facts Roundtable podcast. Please note that today's guest was not sponsored by DBV Technologies or compensated in any way by the sponsor to participate in this specific podcast. Thank you for listening to Facts Roundtable podcast. Stay tuned for future episodes coming soon. Please subscribe, leave a review, and listen to our podcast on Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Stitcher. Have a great day, and always be kind to one another.